think we'll get started. So as usual, could I please request that everyone participating in the webinar turns their video off and make sure that they're muted. And could I please ask someone to put an entry in the chat to confirm that you can hear me? Excellent, thank you very much. So as a reminder, my name is Nick Matheson. I'm one of the PIs in the Cambridge Institute for Therapeutic Immunology and Infectious Disease, CITID, and I'm also an infectious diseases consultant at Adam Brooks Hospital. I'm going to give you a very quick update on the epidemic this week, because the situation hasn't changed significantly since last week, and because we have a guest speaker from outside Cambridge. And obviously, we're all coronavirus experts now, but Chris Coleman has the distinction of working on coronaviruses before the COVID-19 epidemic. So I'm really looking forward to his perspective. So, in brief, I've again borrowed my slides from the UK government. As you'll have heard on the news, the number of new cases of COVID-19 has indeed peaked and is now, if anything, trending downwards. And so this has translated to falling bed occupancies across the country, particularly in London. So it's definitely fair to say that as regards the first wave of the pandemic, we are past the peak. It's also the case that, as shown on this graph, cumulative cases, well, actually accumulated deaths in this case on the y-axis, days on the x-axis. It's also the case that, as previously, deaths in the UK are unfortunately closely following those in Italy. Only we, of course, were forewarned and are running 2 weeks behind. So what does the situation look like locally? The answer is very similar to the national picture, with a peak in admissions to Adam Brooks Hospital shown in the panel on the left around April 7th. Really, in terms of both admissions and bed occupancy, we continue to follow the predictions we made back on March 24th. Shown by the black line. The question is obviously, where do we go from here? And of course, we don't know the answer to that, but I've been giving quite a bit of thought to this from the point of view of Adam Brooks Hospital to inform our planning going forward. And so I thought I'd share with you my general thoughts on the subject. And once again, I'm happy to answer questions or receive feedback by email. And this is very much a work in progress. So, my general thinking is as follows. Essentially, I'm working on the following assumptions. First, that less than 10% of the Cambridge catchment population has been infected during this first wave. I feel pretty confident on that point, but of course, until we have hard serological data, we can't be sure. It's fair to say most people would think that number will come in significantly under 10%. Secondly, the stated policy of the UK government is aimed at partially lifting the lockdown whilst maintaining R0, the number of new cases for each existing infection, at less than one. And then assumption three is that if that policy is unsuccessful, there's a breakthrough, then it's likely that the doubling time of any resurgence in cases will be prolonged compared with the first wave, because it will be occurring on the background of some existing social distancing measures. Fourth, that the UK government policy would then be aimed at suppressing those sorts of breakthroughs with further lockdowns or enhanced social distancing if necessary. And finally, we should, however, keep in mind that UK government policy is calibrated at the national level rather than aiming specifically at Cambridge. This has benefited us to date, but the reverse may be true in the future. And it's also possible that UK government policy may be compromised by error or incomplete adherence by the population. And so in practice, we're thinking about three sorts of possible scenarios. These are obviously very important for the hospital, but they're important for us in our general lives as well. And so scenario one is the suppressed scenario. So that is similar to early in the epidemic, sporadic cases controlled by social distancing and enhanced isolation, case finding and quarantine. So that's the most optimistic scenario going forward, but it may mandate maintenance of really very significant social distancing policies. Scenario number two is the intermittent lockdown scenario. So that is essentially a fluctuating baseline of cases but likely with the peak height less than or equal to the first wave and with a longer periodicity for the reason I mentioned previously. And then third is the sort of worst case scenario or a second wave, which would be if one of those fluctuations is incompletely suppressed, either because of a change in government policy or because of a breakdown in adherence by the population. And in that scenario, we may have something that looked more similar to our reasonable worst case scenario first time round. So those are the sorts of scenarios we're thinking about, and I'm in the process of converting those into numerical predictions for Addenbrooke's Hospital, and I'll let you know when we have something more concrete. However, the point of these two slides really is that although government policy, as it likes to emphasise, may be guided by the science, the path followed up to this point and the way forward from here will be determined by political rather than scientific decisions. And the reason it's difficult to forecast what will happen next, the reason it's difficult for the hospital to plan, is because we can't accurately second guess those decisions. So on that note, I'm going to hand over very shortly to Chris. So Chris Coleman is an assistant professor at the University of Nottingham. He did his PhD in Sheffield in the noughties, and I'm pleased to say that several of his early publications were around HIV. He subsequently spent several years as a postdoctoral fellow at Ohio State and then the University of Maryland before returning to the UK, I think in 2018. And for the last few years, he's been working on human coronaviruses, particularly SARS, that's SARS-CoV, the original SARS, and also MERS. So thank you very much indeed for joining us, Chris, and I will now hand over to you.
Perfect. Can you hear me okay? So thank you, Nick, for this invitation to talk today about the virus that is SARS-CoV-2, or at least coronaviruses in general. As Nick mentioned, I mostly worked on MERS coronavirus in my last postdoc, but this is kind of applicable to this new virus as well. So coronaviruses have a very distinctive morphology when you look at them under an electron microscope. They have a crown structure around the outside of them that makes it look like a crown, and hence their names, coronavirus. They're a diverse group of viruses that infect a wide range of animals, humans, and have very different pathogenicities in different animals and humans. So, for example, there's the less pathogenic human coronaviruses, of which there are four, and these mostly cause mild symptoms with a low death rate, and you get common cold-like symptoms almost every year with these viruses. Then there are two highly pathogenic human coronaviruses, which have severe symptoms and high death rates relatively. So these two were SARS-CoV-1, as it's now named, and MERS-CoV. So both of these viruses emerged in 2002 and 2012, respectively, and they spread to various countries around the world. But most of these cases are concentrated in the country which the virus originally emerged from. So in the case of SARS, it's China. In the case of MERS, it's Saudi Arabia. Most of the cases outside of those regions were from people who traveled to those regions and then returned home and then started showing symptoms and were recorded in those countries. So SARS caused about 8,000 deaths overall and had a case fatality rate of around 10%. And MERS is still ongoing. It's caused about 2,500 cases, but has a very high case fatality rate of about 35%. The reason why MERS hasn't spread further is actually because the R0, or the ability for this virus to transmit, is actually quite low in normal situations. So it's predicted to be less than one normally. It can be as high as 8 in very specific circumstances where there's very close contact between people. Or so, for example, there was an outbreak in South Korea where somebody spread the virus around various hospital settings. In that case, the virus was able to transmit pretty well between the different patients. But even before this outbreak, the WHO had already declared these viruses blueprint priority diseases because they are two viruses that have pandemic potential and for which there's no treatment or vaccination available. So the animal coronaviruses is particularly important are the bat coronaviruses, which are thought to be the source of many human coronaviruses, if not all. And now, of course, we have this new coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, which in terms of death rate, it's not particularly fatal in most people, but it has obviously become pandemic. And also we have to obviously rename SARS-CoV to SARS-CoV-1 now. So this is an old version of the map, but it just illustrates that SARS-CoV-2 has truly become pandemic, and vast majority of countries are now reporting cases, and they have high case numbers, and it's spread all the way around the world. So coronavirus is a zoonotic. So for SARS and MERS, this is obviously better understood than it is for the current SARS outbreak, the SARS-2 outbreak. So in bats, we have what are called SARS-like and MERS-like coronaviruses, which recombine with each other, and they form animal strains of these viruses. So SARS was in civet cats, and MERS is in dromedary camels. And in these intermediate hosts, the viruses cause a mild disease, if any, and it's highly transmissible between these animals. And then from there, there's generally only small mutations in the genome of these viruses, point mutations that make them pathogenic to humans, or they already are pathogenic to humans in their intermediate host, and they just pass on to humans, in which they cause a severe disease. So obviously we predict now that there's SARS-CoV-2-like coronaviruses in bats somewhere. The intermediate host is suggested to be pangolins, but it may be other animals as well. Although civet cats were the main poster boy for SARS, the original SARS, it did infect other small mammals as well. And MERS, although the only source is the dromedary camel, it does also infect other closely related camelids. So these viruses do infect a range of species, or closely related species. So why is there a difference in the pathogenicity of these viruses? Well, one theory is that the less pathogenic human coronaviruses, the four of them, are jumped into humans much longer ago than SARS and MERS. And so they've adapted to humans, and they have gone endemic in humans, whereas SARS and MERS are newer, and so are causing a more severe problem at this time. And of course, this was before the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak, but that would explain why that has gone pandemic, because it hasn't been seen by humans before. And it could be that 50, 100 years ago, HKU1 or one of these other viruses was circulating, went pandemic, but it wasn't recorded as such because we didn't know at the time that's when it was. So going on to the molecular biology of coronaviruses. So coronaviruses have a very large positive sense RNA genome of about 30 kb. The genome has non-structural proteins towards the 5' end, and there's 16 non-structural proteins that are created as two large polyproteins, 1A and 1B. They're then cleaved up into the 16 separate pieces. That includes things like the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase complex, which is responsible for copying the genome and making the messenger RNA from the genome. Interestingly, for RNA viruses, coronaviruses also have three proofreading enzymes, which modify the RNA as it's been made, or correct the RNA, any mistakes. Generally we think that coronaviruses don't mutate very much as they replicate. Unlike other RNA viruses, we get large swarms of different mutants over time. For coronaviruses, you do get point mutations, of course, but it seems to be a little bit suppressed by having these proofreading enzymes that correct any mistakes in the RNA as it's being replicated. We have the structural proteins that make up the physical structure of the virion. The nuclear capsid protein binds the RNA and keeps it inside the virion. The most important surface protein is the spike protein, which is the receptor that the virus uses to enter cells. But there are also two small membrane proteins, E and M, which may be ion channels or may have other functions in replication. And then there are accessory proteins. So these are variable in number and in function between different coronaviruses. This is actually the MERS-CoV genome, I should have mentioned. And so MERS has five accessory proteins that are there in amongst the structural proteins. But other coronaviruses have different numbers of these, and they're named differently as well. So when I was a postdoc, we cloned the genes from MERS-CoV into plasmids. that added a GFP tag to them, so you could look at their subcellular localization. So this is just 15 of them. You can see they have different localizations within the cell. We can group them. Some of them go cell-wide. Some of them are only cytosolic, because you can see the shadow of the nucleus and other organelles through the GFP signal. And then others are localized to specific organelles. And this is partly dependent on what their function is, of course. So the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase components are mostly cell-wide or cytosolic in this format because they're expressed on their own, which is where they will mostly act, and they will complex together to replicate the RNA, but on their own they just simply go everywhere. So we did a bit of work specifically on one of these accessory proteins, P4B, which is strongly localized to the nucleus. So when you transfect cells with P4B, a type of GFP, it strongly localizes to the nucleus. Using luciferase reporter assays for innate immune signaling pathways, one which is dependent on the interferon beta promoter and one which is dependent on the NF-kappa-B promoter, P4B was able to block these pathways. We were able to remove the nuclear localization sequence from this protein and show that it was still able to inhibit these pathways. Later studies, not by us, have shown that P4B actually blocks the translocation of NF-kappa-B from the cytosol to the nucleus. So the SARS-CoV-2 genome looks very similar to the MERS genome. So you have the non-structural proteins towards the 5' end, you have the structural proteins, and then in this case you have six accessory proteins which are named differently just based on their reading frame number. Coronaviruses have a very distinct replication cycle. So again, this is just an example for MERS, but it's basically the same for all coronaviruses. There are small differences, but not major. So MERS binds to the receptor DPP4, enters the cell by endocytosis, is trafficked through the cell, and then the virion fuses with the endosome membrane to deposit the RNA into the cytoplasm, where you get the RNA transcription and replication, protein synthesis. And then you get assembly in the ER Golgi intermediary complex, and then the virus is exocytosed, and then the vesicle pops onto the surface and releases the virus from the cell. So over the time, we developed different assays to quantify the replication cycle from MERS. So this is an example. So we had pseudovirus assays for entry and fusion, which I'll come on to in a minute. RT-PCR for RNA replication. You can do Western blots for protein synthesis, and you can look for the titer of the virus as it's released, because it's highly cytopathic. So it forms nice plaques in plaque assays. So how can this all be used for drug discovery? So if we can understand how these coronavirus proteins function, or understand the coronavirus replication cycle, we can screen approved drugs, or we can design and screen novel drugs against the coronaviruses, and then we can test those eventually in humans, in animal models, and then in humans. And one of the questions for us is, can we find a pan-coronavirus therapeutic? And that's because the drug discovery process, from a novel compound through to approval, excluding other monitoring that might go on over time, it takes about 10 years, including all the in vitro testing, then the clinical trials, and then all the paperwork at the end. But coronaviruses have not even lasted long enough to have completed this timeline, even if we were able to start right at the start with a novel compound. So the original SARS lasted about a year, but was eliminated from humans without any approved therapy or vaccination. It was a case of effective quarantine of people that were infected and destruction of the intermediate host animals that ultimately led to the elimination of SARS from the population. MERS has been going on for about 7 years now. Don't know how long it's going to carry on for. And then obviously SARS-CoV-2 has just come on the scene. So As I said, coronaviruses, although the accessory proteins of these viruses are very different, they do have some similarities. So all coronaviruses have these 16 non-structural proteins and also have the structural proteins. And most of these have very, very similar functions in all the coronaviruses. Now, there are differences, of course, like, for example, in the S or the spike protein, there is quite a lot of difference because they use different receptors. But others of these could be targeted as pan-coronavirus with pan-coronavirus therapeutics. So, for example, the non-structural proteins, there are a large number of enzymes encoded in that, in the NSPs, which perform a range of different functions in the virus replication cycle. So I've just listed them here. So including the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, the proofreading enzymes, an RNA helicase, and some proteases. So these could certainly be targeted for pan-coronavirus therapeutics in the future. And indeed, when I was, again, we screened a large number of FDA-approved drugs against SARS and MERS, or SARS-1 and MERS, and we found drugs that inhibited both SARS and MERS. So it is possible to find these drugs that inhibit both of these viruses, at least both of these viruses, and potentially also SARS-2. This is just them grouped by their different function. So the one that we worked on and published on, in fact, was the Abl kinase inhibitors. So these inhibit the Abl kinase pathway. So we did time course experiments, and I'm not going to go through all the detail of that, but we basically excluded everything after from and after RNA replication by adding drugs at different times post-infection. We were able to observe trafficking of pseudoviruses expressing SARS and MERS spike to exclude that possibility. So then we were left with the Abl kinase inhibitors inhibited virion fusion. And indeed, that's true. So we had a reporter pseudovirus assay where there's a lentivirus that expresses SARS or MERS spike and has the enzyme beta-lactamase inside it. When this virus enters the cell and fuses, the beta-lactamase is deposited into the cell. And then if you load the cell up with a dye called CCF2, the beta-lactamase will cleave this dye, which is normally green, into a blue form, which you can then observe by flow cytometry. So this is the example from our paper. So on the second row there, when you the more blue, the more fusion there is. So on top row there's basically zero fusion, because and then on the middle row you have 55% of the SARS spike and 32% with the MERS spike. And what the Abl kinase inhibitor in this particular case was imatinib. So when we add in imatinib, the fusion of the virions is significantly reduced, and we can quantify that over a number of repeats for statistical purposes, and we can see that fusion is significantly inhibited by the addition of imatinib. So these Abl kinase inhibitors block the coronavirus fusion, and they do this to SARS and also MERS. Finally, is I just want to say a little bit about the animal models for these viruses. And this is interesting because SARS-CoV-2 uses the same receptor as SARS-CoV-1, which is ACE2, or angiotensin converting enzyme 2. So for SARS-1, SARS infects mice very well, but you don't get a mild disease in these mice. So what had to be done was it had to be passaged from one mouse to another. We do this just the once, you get an infection and a mild disease again. But they ended up doing a total of 15 times to derive a mouse-adapted strain called MA15, which caused a strong infection in mice and caused a very severe disease, and it could even be fatal in certain mouse strains. So this kind of work at the moment for developing mouse models for SARS-CoV-2 is ongoing. There are reports coming out of different models. The ferrets apparently are very well infected with SARS-2, and also cats in lab. So in summary, SARS-CoV-2 is a typical coronavirus, structurally and genetically. It encodes non-structural structural accessory proteins. It's probably similar to most other coronaviruses, and the drugs do have the potential to be pan-coronavirus, because we've shown this before with SARS-1 and MERS, but we're working now on finding drugs that obviously inhibit SARS-2. And so that's it. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Chris. So if you wouldn't mind just staying on the line with your microphone on, we'll go through a few questions, if that's all right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to take the privilege of the first one myself, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And so one thing we've been reflecting on is that in the case of HIV, there are a large number of nucleoside and nucleotide analogues, which are very effective antivirals. It doesn't seem like the RNA polymerases in coronaviruses, or actually possibly other positive sense RNA viruses, are so easy to drug with these compounds. Is that because of the proofreading capability, do you think, or is there some other reason that I'm missing?
I would say that only, I'm not going to say only, but I know of not many other coronaviruses have proofreading activity, so it's not a thing that's common for RNA viruses at all, and it's only really because coronaviruses encode so many proteins relative to other RNA. I mean, if you were normally you'd be looking at 10 to 15 proteins total for an RNA virus, but this has 16 non-structural proteins alone, so for an RNA viruses that's a lot. I don't know, there must be something structurally different about RNA-dependent RNA polymerases and DNA, reverse transcriptases or DNA replication enzyme, DNA polymerases that can be used in other virus to treat other viruses.
Now that is interesting, because it does seem on the face of it like there should be lots of active sites which could potentially be targetable, and in fact a much wider array of active sites which could be targeted than in HIV, for instance. Okay, thanks very much.
And they do form like these tight the thing about RNA viruses is obviously that they replicate in the cytoplasm, so they're very sensitive to innate immune sensing molecules that detect foreign RNA. So they're probably quite well protected in terms of the complex to outside interference, let's say. Not to say they can't be inhibited, but that might be an explanation as well.
And then, in terms of questions, there were several questions and a bit of a discussion going on about the mechanism of transmission between species. So, for example, Lalita asks, how do the viruses jump from the bats to the intermediate host? Is it shed in the feces of the bats? Is that known, Chris?
It's very difficult to do that in an easy way, I think, from my understanding. So it's obviously a lot easier with humans to say when did a human come in contact with an animal to get the virus, but with these animals it's a little bit more complicated. It also depends when the infection of the intermediate host happens. So there's evidence that camels, for example, have had MERS infection for many decades, because all camels across North Africa and the Middle East are seropositive for MERS. So it seems to have been a camel pathogen for quite a long time. But it only recently sort of jumped into humans for whatever reason. So going back to sort of find where the contact with the bats was in that kind of situation is even harder.
Interesting. So I was just going to jump forward to a question from Ian Goodfellow, because he'd actually also made some helpful comment on why nukes might not be so useful, suggesting they're good in culture, but maybe not so good in cells and organisms. And that's obviously true, although again, it's not totally clear to me why that shouldn't be the case with HIV. But Ian asks, is there much in the way of recombination seen in coronaviruses?
Well, it's not really my area, but from my understanding, there is a lot of recombination in the bats because bats get a lot of co-infections with coronaviruses, and they recombine with each other quite readily in the bats, which is why you get these different coronaviruses coming about. So there was a paper fairly recently, about 10 years after the SARS outbreak, that showed that you could actually find 10 pieces of the original SARS coronavirus in different coronaviruses in bats in China. So the components are all sort of still there in different coronaviruses. So in bats, there does seem to be a lot of recombination. In terms of humans, I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that. It may just be because co-infections are less common in humans than in these bats, which have a lot of these coronaviruses at the same time. I haven't seen studies of recombination in humans.
And then there's a question about what stage P4B suppresses an F kappa B. I think you alluded to it being relating to the transport, the transcription factor, but perhaps I could ask you to reiterate that. And can I just ask, related to that, is there a P4B analog in SARS-CoV-2, and are there other proteins which are known to antagonize the interferon response in the other coronaviruses?
Yeah, so the first question is, so it wasn't our work, it basically binds to a nuclear portin and prevents the translocation of NF-kappa B. There's a paper out there on that. The second thing, P4B analog. So the accessory proteins do tend to be quite different between different coronaviruses. So there are two, what we did was actually looked into the P4B in two closely related bat coronaviruses called HKU4 and HKU5. And those two also localized the nucleus and also inhibited human innate immune signaling pathways, actually, and we would predict to be in the same way. But between other coronaviruses, the accessory proteins in particular are very variable. So there has to be very closely related for them to have common functions. Having said that, the accessory proteins of all coronaviruses as a general thing do inhibit innate immune signaling pathways. It's been shown for a wide range of different coronaviruses, including mostly on SARS-1, because that was kind of the most interesting coronavirus for a long time. And then there's also some innate immune signaling inhibitors within the non-structural proteins as well.
And then if I could ask another one of my own questions, if that's all right, Chris. In terms of the very different pathogenicities of the different viruses, and in particular, obviously SARS-CoV-1 and CoV-2 share the same receptor, but the case fatality rate is obviously quite different. Do you have any insight into that, or even whether you think that's likely to be a cell autonomous thing or some other factor?
Yeah, I mean, that's just a difficult question to answer until we know exactly how all these viruses work and, you know, how until the exact, let's say, cytokine storm that is induced by the different viruses, for example, might be different in the two viruses to make one, you know, so those kind of things will kind of come out as time goes on and this is studied in more detail, I would say.
It's difficult at this stage. I might just take one more question, because there have been a couple of questions about the entry process and the pH dependency. And I was just going to ask you one question, because obviously there's been a lot of press coverage about hydroxychloroquine and also azithromycin, which may modulate lysosomal pH. And so I was just wondering whether you had any insight into similarities or differences in the fusion processes for these different coronaviruses.
Yeah, so the only difference that was between SARS-1 and MERS was that, I'm probably going to get this wrong way around now, but the SARS-1 fused early in the endosomal pathway and MERS fused late. So there was a difference in the timing of the fusion. I may be the wrong way around there, but either way, so there is difference, but it's still endocytosis. It still does seem to be pH dependent. Actually, in the table there that I showed of the drug categories that we had some antiparasitic agents which inhibited both SARS and MERS, and one of those was chloroquine. So it did inhibit both of those viruses in vitro. There's obviously now questions regarding whether or not this can be used because of the pharmacological characteristics of the drug and so on. That's kind of a different question. We don't know the dosing that would be required in a human to inhibit the virus and all the rest of it. But certainly we found it was an inhibitor of SARS and MERS in our original screen.
Cool. And did you look at azithromycin by any chance?
I don't have the full list with me. I can check, but not that I recall.
Excellent. Well, look, thanks very much, Chris. That was brilliant. And as I say, it really is great to talk to someone with a track record of working on and making interesting discoveries about coronaviruses. So thanks very much to Chris, and thanks to everyone for listening. I will hopefully see you again in a week's time.